From KCRW, this is Here Be Monsters.
And fuck, when I was 8 or 9, then I remember playing in a forest next to the house where I grew up. And there was this lump in the forest, and we had a like a child stroller we would run around playing with and driving each other. And I realized, that must have been a burial mound. I mean, I must have been playing on a burial mound as a child without knowing. And then I didn't know as a child. It was just something that was intuitively good to play with. My mom certainly didn't know. My father didn't know. If they did, I'm not sure whether they would have allowed me to play like that or not. And I think it might have been a strong narrative if she'd said I would be punished by the occupants of the mound had I done so.
Let me rewind for a second. Can you teach me how the right way to say it? The underearthlings.
Underjordiske.
One more time.
Underjordiske.
Underjordiske.
Yeah. Underjordiske.
And that literally means underground.
Yeah. Under is under, and jord is earth or ground. So in the thesis I used the word sort of what subterraneans to capture that it's something that's below. Below ground or under earthlings, as you mentioned, could be another way. Underground, it sounds a bit silly, but it's essentially sort of refers to a being, and I prefer saying being than creature that sort of lives in, you know, the burial mounds. So when you look at the tales and the way that they're described, then it's sometimes they're small, pixie-like with red hats. Most of the time, they're just referred to as underearthlings that appear to be rather similar to the humans. So the only difference is that we live on the farmsteads, they live in the burial mounds up or specific sites on the fields.
You're calling them burial mounds?
Burial mounds, yeah. There's one mound there. We just have a mound here. We just passed another one out in the field behind us. There's a really, really beautiful one. Most of them are Bronze Age sort of burial sites. But it was only in the 1937 that prehistoric sites were actually sort of protected by law. So up until that, the only sort of actual protection was the stories about how if you were digging into the burial mound, you would be sort of struck by catastrophe. You would be punished by the inhabitants of the mound. One of the reasons that archaeologists think that quite a few of them still remain in the landscape is because they've been under the sort of protection of the underearthlings. This one, this is called Svenshøj. Sven is a sort of a Danish male name. So the big one there in the field, it's been rumored, it's one of the tales, that this is a place where a lot of subterraneans meet. So we'll just run down and look, and then we'll go to Reginjord.
Here Be Monsters, the podcast about
what happens in the back garden.
The podcast about
the unknown.
I mean, it's definitely beautiful, yeah.
Definitely.
Do you see, I mean, you grew up here. Do you see the beauty of the place you came from, or is it hard to see that?
No, I think I see it more now than growing up. Because growing up, then, well, this is just where you live. But actually having the opportunity to return, in a sense, with the project
to actually be able to study the landscape, I think I appreciate it much more now than I did while growing up.
Is it quite
windy though?
Is it always this windy here?
No, but it can be a lot windier than this. I mean, always on the top of these mounds, you feel the wind a bit more.
Yeah.
So this is a bit taller than the one up there. I think this one is even bigger.
Yeah. Just in a couple sentences, can you say where we are and what would be underneath us if we could see what was underneath us?
Well, we are at a burial mound called Southern Mound or Sønderhøj, in the parish of Ibsker, John Bornholm. It's a burial mound. It's probably 5 to 6 meters tall. Depending on the kind of gaze we have, if we were to look into the mound, we would either expect to find some sort of burial, perhaps a bronze sword. There might be gold. If we were to look in the more magical way, then this would be the dwelling place of the families of subterraneans. They would have the living room where they would do their baking, brew their beer, and where they would be with their families. And then from time to time, they would venture out. And then other than that, then you mostly hear about them when there's some sort of quarrel between the subterranean inhabitants and then the people that are sort of plowing too close to the mound, or they have some sort of disagreements of how to utilize the landscape.
Yeah.
Other than that, they take care of themselves.
Can you say your name and the title of your thesis?
Yeah. I'm Lars Christian Kofod Rømer, Lars Christian Kofod Rømer in Danish. It's a PhD in anthropology, and it's called, what is it called actually? Tales of a Subterranean Landscape. Tales in an Underground Landscape. We'll have to look at it. I can't remember now actually. Well,
3 years of your life.
Yeah. I'll have to think. This one, you can actually see when you get a bit closer that that's part of it has been sort of chopped away. You can see it better here. It probably used to be a sort of perfect sphere or a perfect half sphere, but there's a part of it that's been destroyed. And the tale related to that is that they were building a new stables at the farm right down there. So they began taking earth from the burial mound to use as a platform for the stables. And then after they began doing that, then the stables got hunted. They couldn't close the doors. There was a stallion that always escaped. And then they gave up taking more ground from the burial mounds. There's certainly a sort of many of these tales where it's not about a prince and a princess once upon a time in a land far, far away. It's about, you know, the farmhand from that farm who was out one day cultivating that particular site. So you can actually sort of look at it in relation to the actual landscape. And you can see through the trees there. Hmm. There's a story about a farmer from a farm down here, and he was out just plowing the field, and it's intense heat, and as he gets close to this burial mound, then he can smell bread, freshly baked bread. So this one, when he is right next to the mound, then he can see that there's this sort of what do you call that in English? The sort of the shovel you use for pizza, like the bread.
Pizza peel.
Yeah, the pizza peel or the bread peel. Mm-hmm. There's a broken one of those lying on the mound. And for some reason, then subterraneans are not really fond of steel or iron, so they can't really fix it. But luckily he has a nail and a hammer, so he, you know, he fixes the peel and then continues his work. And then when he returns and a little bit later, then there's a plate of soup and pork and something to drink and some bread. And as a sort of gesture from the subterranean inhabitants of the mound, as a thank you for him preparing their peel. And then he eats and then moves along. So there's this sort of interchange between humans being punished by the subterraneans when they actually sort of interfere with the burial mounds and dig into them, or have the animals grass on top of them, like pissing and shitting into the dwellings of the subterraneans, then you get punished in one way or another. But on the other hand, if you actually help out, then you will be rewarded. So that's in many ways it's similar to how we interact with each other as humans. There's not really any sort of necessity in them being evil or necessarily being good either.
Right. So one thing that's a little bit unclear to me is, you know, there's different ways of believing something to be true.
Yeah.
Right. There's like maybe I'm just kind of thinking off the cuff here, but like on one end of the scale you have like Santa Claus, right?
Yeah.
Where it's something that you kind of believe is true so that you can tell your children it's true, so that you can get a certain kind of behavior out of them that is seen as pro-social, which is like good behavior from children, right? You have something kind of in the middle, which is, say, like Sasquatch, right? Where it's like this creature that some people believe is true, maybe not the majority, like believe it is like really out there, but just very shy. Sasquatch is not usually seen as like a magical creature in any way, having any kind of supernatural things, but just a kind of this ape that has evaded capture for as long as time has been around, or as long as the species has been around. And then maybe one step past that is something like God, which is highly invisible and highly powerful, right? And kind of undetectable for all sorts of reasons. And a lot of people believe in God, right? When you've been talking to Bornholmers, right? Bornholmers. What kind of belief is the belief in subterraneans?
Yeah, I think it actually covers all aspects, and we have a problem as well with the notion of belief. Because for some, these are great tales and told by sort of school teachers in the kindergarten, as you say, as a means of getting the children to respect the landscape. So that's sort of the completely disenchanted version of the stories, and it's a very functional and pedagogical. And then there's this, as you say, this in between. I've met people who've seen them, and then there are all the people, like the majority, who have had no personal experiences, and some like to believe that it would be nice if they existed to keep us humans in balance. And one of the main results of the project has been looking at how there's this notion of that back in the days in the old ways of Bornholm, then the majority of the people would believe that subterraneans existed. And then people usually make references to Iceland or elsewhere in the world. Well, there they still believe, but we can't really believe here because we've been modern, and this is something that we've been sort of detached from this. But then when you start talking to people that will sort of on the first hand sort of reject the notion of this being sort of part of the contemporary world, then a lot of them are sort of, their initial rejection is sort of as a means of protecting themselves because they don't want to appear as foolish. So then some of them actually have stories, or they have family members or something like that, but it takes a bit of time to actually tease out what they really think about it. So I think in a contemporary world, then a lot of these phenomenons and these tales has been turned into a matter of belief. So I think a lot of what's going on, at least just looking at Bornholm, is that there's an idea that back in the days people believed and this was real for everybody. But if you look at the records from the 16th century onwards, then there's this already at that point of time, there's the notion that in old days people believed, but now there are only a few sort of stupid women believing it. But that was in the 17th century. So that story, it's not about being ridiculed or not about showing that, well, people are still irrational or people are still silly. Leave all of that to one side and then just, from my point of view, look at what people are actually doing, how they interact with the surroundings. And then we might get a little bit wiser in terms of what actually happens in the landscape.
You said 400 years ago.
Yeah.
People were saying that, oh, only some people believe in things. It's like what we call old wives' tale.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? That was 400 years ago.
Yeah.
But the belief is still...
Exactly. Here. So the modern history is the idea about the past is enchanted. It's like if we talk about it in the present, then it's about those savages elsewhere in the world, something that is either distant in the past or distant, like, geographically in the present. But it's more interesting that it's actually just right here. It's just that mound. I mean, for me, that's where it's get interesting. I think perhaps why there was so much talk about this project, because it was, like, had it been an anthropological sort of study of shamanism in Siberia or something in the Amazon, then there would have been the public expectation that, of course, people have spirits and stuff like that. You would actually expect the study to be about some sort of magic. But when it's about the, like, what happens in the back garden, then I think that's where it gets a bit more controversial. There's the risk of being ridiculed and being deemed as a goof or a fool. And so that it's much safer to say that, well, yes, certainly back in the days, a lot of people on Bornholm believed in subterraneans, but they don't anymore. Then you can actually, there's a way of talking about the phenomenon, but in a safe, distant way.
Am I understanding what you're saying, right? That, like, when other people have magic, of course they do because they're, like, underdeveloped or something like that. But this kind of understanding of magic is really something that's quite local as well.
Yeah, I mean, there's many places in the world where you can find this sort of the sense that, well, it's that if you live in the lowlands of the Amazon, then the most powerful shamans will be the one in the hills. But oppositely, then the ones living in the hills, then the most powerful shamans will be in the lowlands. So there's certainly sort of magic in distance. I think I'll just have to move the car because there's a bus approaching.
There's a bus approaching.
But yeah, there was quite a bit of fuss in the beginning when I received the grant from the Danish Independent Research Councils, where I was suddenly transformed in media from being an anthropologist, essentially just trying to do the same work in Denmark as anthropologists has been doing for centuries, sort of in the third world. But that's quite quickly sort of change from being an anthropologist to being an esteemed paranormal investigator that was hired by the Danish government to go to Bornholm to capture trolls. I think the beauty of modern technology is that these stories can travel so fast, and you can see how Google Translate can literally fuck things up in an instant, and then the journalists don't really have any time to check. But I started receiving these like sort of requests from Argentine, from RT.com, and different people asking me what techniques I was planning to use to capture the trolls and stuff like that, which was amusing at one hand, but also sort of not really what I was supposed to do. So I decided not to do that much in terms of managing the media. How are we?
I'm just gonna stop very shortly here.
Oh, okay.
Because the stone there.
Which stone? Oh, the big one.
The big stone, yeah. That was left when the ice retracted at the end of the ice age. And you have these boulders different places in Bornholm. Some of them have tales about that they've been thrown by trolls living in southern Sweden, and they were thrown when they began sort of building the churches in the Middle Ages. The trolls didn't like churches. This one is sort of a bit peculiar.
That's
cup marks or copules, so that's sort of a rock art, presumably from the Bronze Age as well. So all of these are cup marks, which have also given this stone the name of, like, the devil's bowling alley, because it's been something that the devil has been able to pick up and sort of toss it.
But because these look kind of be like the giant's fingerprints.
Exactly, like the giant's fingerprints. But either way, when I moved to Bornholm, then my oldest daughter wanted to start as a scout. Sort of coincidentally, it turned out that some of what they were doing in the scout club was talking about tales about subterraneans. And one day they were told stories about the subterraneans. They carved these little wooden knives. And then by nightfall, they sort of formed a line. And then they walked out here through the forest. And they gathered here in front of the stone. And then the scout leader would tell them that this is a place, this is a subterranean dwelling. And that if we stomp the ground, there would be a hollow sound. And
there is a hollow sound.
Yeah.
Wait, can you do that again? No, I can feel it in my feet.
And then so she would tell her this is because that the subterraneans live here, and we have to respect their dwelling and protect them. And then the children would sort of in the lines, they would take turns of sort of putting their wooden knives sort of as an offering in the cup marks, and then stand back, and then by magic a bag of golden chocolate coins would appear, and they would have a bit of candy, and then return to the scout house. There's still something going on, but where people take the time to make a little miniature gesture towards the surroundings, and then in the scout club, the main effort was not for the children to actually believe in the existence of subterraneans. It had that effect on some of the children, but the main aim was to use the story as a way of educating the children that we have to respect our surroundings, and there's a life in nature that is outside of ours, and we have to respect that. And this is sort of a very, I think, basic way that regardless of the question of belief and existence, this kind of stories tied to particular places in the landscape can still do something and can still be used as a sort of a vehicle for creating a particular type of relationship. It would be so much easier if we could just talk about it as stories. But when you get to meet actual people, you have to look at the personal elements of them as well. And that's where it gets a little bit more tricky, because you can't really fit it into one box. Oh, that's just like Santa Claus, or no, that's like Sasquatch, or no, that's like God, because they can be all of these, depending on not just the person, but also on the context within which you talk to the person.
What are we looking at? What's in front of us here?
This is just a sort of a typical Bornholm shoreline. You know, different species of pine and some moss and grass, and then you have the rolling waves of a completely rocky shore. There's no beach whatsoever. If you look closely, some of the places you can actually see the remains of small pools where they've kept the fish, probably in the Middle Ages. And right now it's a fenced area where you have sheep grassing in the summer.
Do you think you'll live the rest of your life here?
Yeah, I think so. I've always felt that this was home, that my time in Copenhagen was temporary, that was something I had to do out of necessity in terms of getting an education and stuff like that, but it's never felt like a place I wanted to stay and live. Like it's never been a home. It's always been going home to Bornholm. Not sure whether I really have the sense of being at home or belonging. I think that's a work in progress. That's something you continually have to work on. But I'm really inspired by the landscape, but I want to learn more, and I want to get more familiar with it. And that's going to take quite a few years. Yeah. What happens then, we'll figure that out. Yeah. But I could definitely see myself living here for the remainder of life and becoming this old, grumpy sort of man that knows the tales and hopefully can still be active and enjoy the landscape.
Thank you. Lars Christian Kolfo-Rema is an anthropologist who lives on the Danish island of Bornholm with his family. If you ever visit Bornholm, be sure to go to his wife's restaurant, where I ate the best pierogies I've ever had. The dissertation that Lars wrote is called Tales in an Underground Landscape. My name is Jeff Entman. I produced this episode with help from Bethany Denton. Many thanks to Reggae Howd, who is many things. She is the maker of beautiful radio art. She was my host when I visited Bornholm. She connected me initially to Lars, and she's interviewed Lars as well for the wonderful podcast Shortcuts. In Reggae's interview with Lars, Lars tells the story of how the Under-Earthling Army once helped a lone patrolman fend off the Swedish Navy. I've put a link up to that piece over on our website, hbmpodcast.com. Also on our website, some photos of Lars and some links to some really bad articles about troll hunting. Again, we're hbmpodcast.com. Music on this episode by Cirocell and The Black Spot. Here Be Monsters is distributed by KCRW. Our senior editor there is Kristen Lepore. We get additional support for freelance contributions from KCRW's Independent Producer Project. If you like this show that we make, please leave us a kind review wherever you listen. And thank you for listening. More episodes soon.